Today we're talking to Fruit Ninja and Jetpack Joyride designer Luke Muscat as we talk about the transition of going from big hit mobile games to a solo game developer on Steam.
You're listening to Make the Game with Matt Hackett.
Luke, thanks a lot for joining me today. We met through our mutual friend, Dave, who came from Play Canvas. I believe the two of you met together through Sony. Do I get that right? Back in the
past? Snapchat.
Through Snapchat. You have a fascinating career. You have designed games such as Fruit Ninja and Jetpack Joyride. And these days, you have jumped into the indie dev, especially the solo dev pool, which is a particular interest of mine. So there's a lot of cool stuff to talk about, and I appreciate you being here. Thanks for joining us.
It's a pleasure to be here. I love just talking design and talking games.
Love it. There was some feelers I put out on Twitter to see if anybody had some questions. I've got my questions of my own, but there were such fantastic questions on Twitter. I definitely think we're going to get into some of those. One of them comes from our own friend Thomas Stewart from YouTube, who we talked to just recently. Great question, and I think a good transition for me from us starting with your kind of corporate, big hit mobile game background, all the way to what did your transition look like from corporate game dev to solo indie dev for you?
Sure. I mean, it's interesting because Fruit Ninja and Jetpack Joyride don't feel like corporate game dev to me compared to when I was working at Snapchat. So when we did Fruit Ninja and Jetpack Joyride, that was obviously when I was working at Half Brick Studios. At the time, Half Brick Studios was, when we were making Fruit Ninja, we were only 30 people, but my team, the team that I ran, was, I think there were 7 of us, and we were working on 2 games at once. So the core Fruit Ninja team was myself and 1 programmer and 1 artist.
Wow.
And I was working on 2 games at the same time. So that felt like really indie to me, obviously, because now the games have been so successful and they're so well known, they almost feel kind of like corporate. But at least in my mind, those are really grassroots indie kind of games.
Interesting.
At least the first versions of them. And it's funny because I've kind of done this transition twice now, because I was at Half Brick. Half Brick had all that success. It grew. The studio was over 100, I think it was 120 people or so. Wow. And then I quit and started a new studio, which was pretty great, with my with 2 other ex-Half Brick people, Phil Larson and Hugh Walters. So that was a big going from corporate. I'm doing air quotes, which is not going to show up in the podcast. I'm doing corporate to really indie, where it was just us 3 kind of building something up again. And then after 3 years of that, we were acquired by Snapchat. So then we went full corporate, right? Actually crazy corporate, where there's, if you contact HR, there's an entire HR department, not just you swivel on your chair and be like, hey, Phil, I don't know what to do about this. It's no, there's an entire building of people of HR who do HR.
Right.
And so it's kind of I don't know, I feel like I'm in this pattern now of being indie and then something growing and then, becoming more corporate and then going all the way back to super indie. And this is, this has kind of been a whole pattern for my career. And I don't know, I think the thing for me about being really indie, and especially now being solo indie, is it's just about getting back closer to the games, right? When you're in a corporate environment, there's a lot to think about. There's a lot of people involved. You spend a lot of time in meetings. And then when you're super indie, you're just spending 95% of your time just thinking about the game. And I don't know, it feels very pure, I guess, in a way. So I don't know, I feel like I've done this this cycle so many times that I almost don't feel that much about it, other than yes, finally I'm just doing game dev again. And not not dealing with all of the stuff that comes with being in a corporate position.
Interesting. Yeah. Would you say that you're kind of this has been sort of a yin yang for you to go into corporate and power up maybe your cash and power up your skills and then dip into indie and use those skills and spend that money on indie stuff and then kind of go back as needed and Like, has that been true for you? Like kind of a nice cycle between the two?
A little bit. I mean, I would say that, you know, when I did join Snapchat, it was because it offered me a new experience and like a whole new career experience, I guess. Especially something like Snapchat, right? Especially being in Australia, like we don't have huge mega game studios, right? Like, I mean, that's not entirely true now because I think there's a few offshoots of different studios here. But like generally speaking, a lot of the industry is made up of small indies. And so, you know, when we were pretty great and we started talking to Snapchat about joining them, we were talking about like, you know, we were creating an entirely new platform, reaching an insane number of players, because it was like the total like addressable market there is absolutely massive. And we're doing something that like we just don't have. I would never really have any other opportunity to do that, right? To be a part of like a multi-thousand person Silicon Valley company. And I always knew like, look, this isn't necessarily where I'm going to be forever. This isn't like a forever move for me, but yeah, I want to have that kind of experience. And I knew that there would be parts of that that I wouldn't like, which is you're dealing with like a huge company and all of the kind of things that happen when you're working with like a huge company, right? But this is like such a unique experience for me. It was an incredibly fulfilling and interesting part of my career. But then inevitably, I know what's going to happen, which is like, yeah, after like 3 or 4 years, I'm like, oh God, I just cannot sit in another meeting. I can't, you know, have really long discussions about does this fit with like a larger corporate strategy, which makes sense. You have to do those things in those environments. But, you know, there's always going to be that part of me that just wants to be like, you know, really in the nuts and bolts of games and game design, especially. I don't know. I think every time I've gone through the cycle, it's been for a different reason. So even though it has been cyclical, I guess, in terms of where I've gone from and to, it's always been for a different reason. And the main thing for me this time for going solo was that I just really wanted to start learning new things. So when I was at Snapchat, I was doing a lot of the same thing that I've always done, which is kind of like a creative director role where I'm kind of overseeing like more than one title at one time, which is great. I find that rewarding, but it had been a long time since I'd really learned something brand new. Like I was sort of really doing something that I've been doing. What had it been? Like, I think when I left Snapchat, it was like maybe 16 years I've been doing games design.
Wow.
And, you know, probably at least 12 of those years in like a leadership position. And I was just like, I really just want to feel like a beginner again, you know? And you know what I'm a beginner at is programming and art. So that was really the incentive this time for switching back to solo development, was to like, just to go back and learn something new and keep, instead of just being in that same mode for my career. And it's hard because I don't want to keep going up the chain further than like that, you know, overseeing one or two titles. Like there would be opportunities to be like, oh, well, maybe you could like oversee all kinds of design, or maybe, you know, like have many team leaders under you or something. And that just doesn't interest me because it just takes me further and further away from like actually working on the games themselves. So
right.
This kind of was like both things, right? Taking me back to the games and also forcing me to learn some new skills.
Interesting. Yeah, a lot of folks I talk to these days, ranging from friends and family members, are kind of going through that transition where we're at a certain age and it's like you've been doing a certain task for long enough that's like now it's time to be promoted. And that kind of sometimes lifts you up out of, you know, the IC role where you're individually contributing. And some people are fine with that and they like to kind of direct and, you know, as a composer, like a high level or conductor or something, right? But then sometimes you miss, like, you want to, it sounds like you and I are the kind of people, I want to feel the dirt in my hands.
Exactly.
I got to get my fingerprints on the product. I can't help but poke. And sometimes I just want to like, no, get out of my way. I'm going to do the whole thing.
Yeah, exactly. It's funny, like I think that's true. There is like a lot of people our age. I've been calling it like our quarter life crisis, just because I can't bear to think that it's a midlife crisis.
Right.
It seems too soon for that. But yeah, I know so many people who, you know, have done something similar, or, you know, in other cases, just completely changed careers.
Yeah.
Just being like, man, I cannot deal with the stress of game dev anymore. I'm going to go, you know, be an engineer or something.
Fair.
I feel like it's really common, kind of, you know, like mid 30s to like early 40s, to kind of have that, you know, reassessment of what you really want. And, you know, I would say, especially like, you know, during COVID and everything, that was definitely like a time of reflection for me. It kind of made me really stop and go, okay, what do I really want out of this? And where do I want my career to go next?
Yeah.
And so I think there was like a little bit of an extra spike of people having that kind of change as well.
Definitely. Yeah. I think a lot of people looked right in the eyes of mortality and corporate nationalism and various things. They're like, do I really need to spend the next 20 years doing this job I don't necessarily love? And yeah, I think a lot of people that happened too around that time. Yeah. Such a fascinating transition to go from a higher level leadership role to putting yourself into the thick of it. And it's so entertaining. We can kind of watch you in real time on YouTube. You look like such an old hat, such a pro at YouTube. Maybe it's just editing magic and smoke and mirrors, but you look, you're so capable in Unity. You program everything yourself. You create, you say you're new to artwork, but for some of your games, like you made one where it's kind of Vampire Survivors, but with cars, which is super interesting to me because I'm making a game kind of in that genre called Witchmore. And, you know, you're making, you know, you're kind of mocking your graphics a little bit as you make them in the video. But like, to me, I'm like, what is this artist talking about? Like, these cars look wonderful and the code looks fine. Like, very convincing. But what has that been like to you to go from, it sounds like not a programmer artist at all, to jumping into the deep end where you're doing both as well as designing the game and all production elements? That's a hard, hard thing. And a lot of people try that and fail. So what is it, do you think, that has put you on a path to success there?
So I guess like as a little bit of context, I definitely consider myself beginners in those fields, but so when I went to university, so I started university in 2003, and at the time I joined what was like the games degree. And again, on video, I'm doing big air quotes, the games degree. It wasn't really a games degree at all. It was like a double degree in information tech and communication design. And basically what that meant is they cobbled together a bunch of different subjects to make up kind of like a games degree, right? And what that was like for me is at university, I learned programming and art and realized that I didn't like either of them and was not good at either of them. And, you know, through the magic of like university team projects, I would kind of naturally fall into a leadership and design role before I even really knew, like before any of us really knew like how games teams worked, right? So I was never taught any design at university, but it just felt like that's how I could best contribute because I was really not good at programming or art. Hmm. So that being said, when I'm doing this now, when I'm starting, I do have like an education in programming and art. And that's really helpful because I at least have building blocks. I'm definitely not coming from absolutely nothing. And there have definitely been times where I've done, I've been slowly doing a little bit more and more programming, like in little bits and pieces. So when I was first at Halfbrick, I used to make a lot of prototypes in ActionScript 2 inside Flash, which is, those were the days.
That's a real deal. Putting,
like random snippets of code on timelines at specific keyframes, like just awful spaghetti code stuff.
Oh, yeah. It let you be
and
so
then
messy.
When we were at yeah. And then when we were at Pretty Great, I did write a little bit of code that shipped. I would often do kind of like our menu systems. When we were doing Crash Club, because that was like real-time online multiplayer, our core programmer, Michael Shevchek, did all of what I consider like the hard programming, right? Which is like the actual gameplay and multiplayer and server authoritative stuff and inventory management. But something that I could do to contribute is like, all right, I'm going to do all of the menus, and then I'm just going to like leave comments in where it's like, okay, this is what happens. Like, I've pressed the buy button here, and then Michael, whose nickname is Chevy, Chevy would come in and like go, oh, I see where Luke has kind of tagged this out, and he would connect it up to the, yeah, again, the hard code. So I've always considered myself to be an okay hacker. Like, I think I can make things feel reasonably good. It's just that it being like reasonable, bug-free, extensible code, that is definitely hard. And then art, like, again, I think I'm okay with composition. Like, I kind of can, and I'm okay with critique, like, because I have that theory background from university. I can at least look at, you know, what the game's art looks like and like articulate what works and what doesn't about it. What I'm really bad at is just trying to conjure something out of nothing. You know, the idea of like having a pencil and a blank page is just like terrifying to me.
Oh yeah.
Midjourney has been really good for me for that. I don't necessarily like just drop in Midjourney art, but a lot of the time I use that essentially as like a concept, like a piece of concept art, and then I'll often like draw over the top of it. And that at least gets me like a little bit of the way there, right? Like I can, it's just like the starting from nothing that is, I just have literally no idea how anyone can do it. And so a Midjourney like kind of gives me that step, and then I can kind of extend from there, which has been really nice. And, you know, I would say like, I don't know, is it a little bit, it's fun to be like self-deprecating about, you know, my skills in code and art. Like, and at the end of the day, it's like, you know, after, yeah, whatever it's been now, 17 years in the industry, they feel like very underdeveloped skills to me compared to some of the other skills I have. But certainly, you know, if you were, I mean, there's a lot of 18-year-olds who would be better at all of these things than me, but, you know, like,
always true.
It is like, you know, maybe if you're 18 and you haven't like been dabbling with that stuff, it's all a matter of perspective. Like when I'm like, I'm terrible at this, I'm like, well, I think I'm terrible from this. It's really nice that other people don't think it's that bad, but I've been surrounded by like some of the most incredible artists and programmers in Australia and in the world. And it's just impossible for me to not look at my stuff and just think it's like amateur hour shit.
I get you. Yeah, it's all totally relative. Like I've had several, like I made a career out of game programming. I'm a very competent programmer. Most companies would be happy to have me writing code for them, right? But then the other stuff I do, like artwork and game design, I've never had like a salaried position, you know, full-time doing those things. And I would have a really hard, if I'm being honest, I'd have a hard time getting a company to pay me to do that.
Yeah.
Right? So like, I would say relative, like I have a lot more confidence these days as an artist and less so as a game designer, right? But it's all relative, and like it fluctuates over time as you gain experience.
That's it. Like, I think that I'm getting stuff like on the programming side, I'm getting stuff working, but every now and then, like I'll kind of like put like a piece of code up on the screen on the YouTube videos. I don't think anyone really like stops and looks at it, but like if you were like a hiring like programmer at a company and you were like looked at one of those, you would just be like, oh my God, what?
Do not hire this man. Yeah, I've done a live stream and I had people reading the code over my shoulder and they were like, this is not optimized. And I'm like, yeah, I know.
Yeah. I mean, one thing I try to do is I at least know where my limits are and I know what I'm good and I'm not good at. And there I try to design with that in mind. So nothing I write code-wise is going to be like super optimized, right? Like it's just, and I kind of, again, like as a university, I kind of know some of the theory behind it, but like realistically, it would be a very inefficient use of my time if we're talking about efficiencies. Like I could spend a really long time trying to make really optimal code, but I will be slow at it and I'll probably only get halfway there. So
totally.
It makes more sense for me to like know that and not design a game that needs to be heavily optimized.
Right.
Like if I, excuse me. If I like made a game, it's like, oh, it has, you know, the game is you are battling 10,000 AI agents at a time. I knew that's not going to be a good fit for me because yeah. AI is hard. It would need to be very optimized yep. to run that many like AI instances at once. It's just not going to work. But like, yeah. oh, this is a bunch of like really simple mechanics that interact in a novel way and are hopefully like fun and satisfying. But yeah, I can put my, you know, find component inside a nested for loop. It's fine. Like, who cares? All this stuff where it's like, oh, actually, you should use like a for loop instead of a for each. And like, realistically, the kind of games I'm making, that's not going to make a meaningful difference. And so, yeah, I really try to optimize for how my time can be well spent. And same on the art side, right? Like, you know, I've had quite a few friends go like, oh, you're still like using Unity. You should mess around with Unreal. And I'm like, they're like, it looks, you can make games that look so much better. And I'm like, yeah, but look at what I'm drawing. You know, do you think like using Unreal is really a good fit for like my 2D side on grid based roguelite? Like it just doesn't really make sense. And, you know, versus some of my friends who are in there doing like incredible like creature animation and using nanite and other things that I don't understand that generate millions of polygons. I'm like, that's just, I'm never going to be good at that stuff, I don't think. I really try to make sure that I'm at least playing to my strengths.
I get you. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. That's really good tactic for a solo dev because you can only do so much and you kind of have to play the solo dev game as if you were playing like a character, right? You're like, I've got yeah. high strength and high intelligence, no charisma, no constitution. Like, this is what I got to work yeah. with. Let's just pile yeah,
exactly.
forward, right? yeah. So you've had some really cool videos that have really taken off. I think that one of the things that's really interesting about your videos is that you will make like a whole game for one video, which is so interesting because a lot of us out here, we're like a whole game. Like I can barely do that by itself. And you've got a whole video in addition to all this video content you're making, you edit it all together. Really amazing. And doing these two things at once combined with, as we've talked about, these are not necessarily things that you know, have a ton of experience with. So another question from Thomas, they're such good questions. Making an entire game for one YouTube video is a lot, right? Are you going to continue to do that? And that kind of is a good segue into one of my process questions, which is like, correct me if I'm wrong, but it looks like you're putting your feelers out for a game that you're going to like, you know, take all the way to the finish line and ship. And is this part of your process? Are we seeing your process in the open as you make these YouTube videos and experiment with games?
Yeah, absolutely. It's definitely part of the process. So yeah, I guess something that I haven't covered in the videos because I've just kind of been launching in like, here's a game. But the actual thesis behind what I'm doing is, so I know a lot of solo developers that are like, you know, they're on like year three of their 5-year journey or whatever, right? And you see it all the time. Like sometimes like someone will work on a game for like 3 or 4 years and then they release it and it's just like, oh, nobody cares.
It hurts so much, right?
Yeah. And it's just like, that just seems so painful. So kind of the way that I've been approaching it is the reason I'm making, so the entire reason that I'm making these games and making the YouTube videos at the same time is I'm searching for the game that I'm going to like spend more time on. So it's all essentially like a very public pre-production, well, not even pre-production, like ideation process. So what the idea is I spend some time making like an advanced prototype. That's what I've been calling them to myself, at least, is advanced prototypes, and getting them into a state where people can play them, because basically I just want to see what resonates with people and what doesn't. And I'm more or less like searching for a game that kind of captures people's attention. And then I can go, oh, okay, now I'm going to invest a lot more time and energy into that game.
Right.
And the crazy thing is like I could spend 2 years just making stuff that I throw away, right?
Yeah.
before I find something. But I think, like, is that actually any crazier than spending like 5 years on a game and hoping like anyone cares? You know, like it's all just different brands of madness. essentially what I've been trying to do is do like, you know, like how with mobile companies, they'll put out like ads before they even make the game.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
So they'll put it out like, you know, here's a bunch of like ad creative and like, oh wow, everyone's clicking on this thing where it's about, you know, like a cat trying to escape a house or whatever. And they're like, oh, cool, that's what we should be making. I'm kind of doing the same thing, except with like these really quite complete prototypes. And then that kind of goes with like, the reason I'm doing it on YouTube is I want people to like find out about these prototypes and play them, but also each one that fails, that, you know, and in this context, like failure, meaning like it doesn't get worked on beyond the prototype, contributes towards me growing an audience. Cause I really want to like have an audience that I can connect with and that can, you know, and that connects with me and with my work. And so that's kind of like what the rationale is being behind, like, yeah, doing YouTube, doing these games, making them like one video per game. But it is like a tremendous amount of work. Like, yeah. It's actually like outrageous. The video side is surprisingly not too bad as long as I'm thinking about it while I'm doing it. Like, I do a lot of recording while I'm developing. And then I just quickly like annotate like what I did or like if something interesting happened. And then like probably like a whole video takes me, like including the last one that I did, including like writing the script, doing all the recording, doing the edit, and doing the metadata and getting it onto YouTube and ready to go, was 2 days of work. So it's like pretty fast, really, as long as I set myself up for success. Like, there's little sections of the script that I'll write like while I'm making the game. It'll be like, oh, I tried this and it didn't work, but it made this funny bug. I can write that little bit of the script, you know, right there into my notes. And then when it comes to like, oh, I actually need to like build a story out of making this game, and it kind of edit it down to its like most interesting parts, I kind of already have source material there. I'm not trying to just conjure it out of nothing. So
right. So while you're making your game, are you creating little pieces of content that you're going to like, will you like, oh, I'm going to take a second to capture some interesting video that happened and then maybe even record some voiceover to go with it? Is that how it is for you?
I don't do any voiceover, but I just capture a lot of video. And so sometimes I've been trying to get better at it. When I did the Luck of the Draw video, which was the auto battler, I think I just kind of almost recorded everything. I had 380 gigabytes of video.
Ooh. What app do you use to edit?
Oh, this is a nightmare to edit.
What do you drag that into then? Is it like, did it have to, like, you know, I use Final Cut Pro. That would take like, you know, the little circle that fills up, that would take like 18 hours on my computer. Like, what do you use to edit your video?
I'm using DaVinci Resolve. Okay. And I'm on a MacBook Pro M1.
Okay. And is it pretty good, or is it chug with that much
so
data?
Good.
Oh wow.
It's like
okay.
It's actually incredible how fast it can like crunch things together.
All right.
It's like often I'll have Unity open and you know maybe Blender or maybe Pixelmator or whatever. And I'll be recording at 4K all at once. And it just doesn't miss a beat. Like, it's such a, wow. It's such like a beast of a, and yeah, I'm just on a laptop. It's just an absolute beast of a laptop. The thing that makes it really hard is like, it's really hard to get, cause I do like, I really like kind of time lapses or hyperlapses. I don't know why. I just do. I'm a simple man.
They're so fun.
Yeah,
they look so impressive. I think that's one of the things, like, you look so legitimate. There's no like, hey, what's this shady character doing when he, like, we don't see and all of a sudden the game appears. Like, we get to see. That's one of the reasons you look so legitimate, right?
Like, I think one of the things is, you know, the hyperlapse makes it, you don't see the parts where I am stuck or I'm like looking on Stack Overflow or asking ChatGPT or even like you know, like texting a friend or something, like where I'm stuck. Lifeline. Because it all just, it looks so impressive because you take like 3 hours of work and you compress it down to like 10 seconds. And it's just like, you know, it's like that, it looks like a hacking scene from an action movie or something.
Oh yeah, you're in Hackers.
If I was playing that back at real time speed, you would see like the little cursor in Visual Studio just blinking as my brain is like, oh, okay, how do I write a switch statement again? I don't remember the syntax for this. So it makes it look much more impressive than it is. And like my intention isn't to make it look impressive. My intention is it to be entertaining. And so like I try, and you know, like bugs are great. Like bugs are entertaining and everything.
Yeah, they're great.
I can only really have so many, and then I had no idea what to do jokes before it's like not entertaining anymore. So, you know, there's definitely some, just through the process, it probably makes it look like I'm more capable than I am.
Love it. Well, maybe that speaks to your strength as an editor because it looks like magic. question from Yvonne. I hope I have that correct on Twitter. Do you use a game design document for your projects? And I guess also your YouTube videos while you're making them at this point, or do you just skip straight to the, you know, just get the work done, or do you like write anything out?
So I haven't used, it depends, right? Like, classic, it depends on what you consider a game design document, right? So
but that's a good, yeah, good point. I would say literally any, almost any text in any file, like,
yeah, okay,
you know what I mean?
Definitely, like, definitely I have text in files, right? Like, so games, you know, when those. When I started at Half Brick, and we were doing like work for hire work, you had to have very large design documents because it had to be approved by the publisher and then it had to be approved by the license holder. And so I've written my fair share of 100 page plus GDDs. Right?
Wow.
That shit is useless, essentially. And unless you're like, if you're in a really big team and you need to communicate a lot of ideas to a lot of people, then maybe. But realistically, what happens is you spend a lot of time pouring information into a document and then that's where it stays. No one reads the document because it's long and boring. And so...
And outdated.
So this is hard, right? Because like, you know, maybe if I worked at Rockstar and I was working on like GTA 6, I would have a very different perspective on this. But at least from my perspective, in terms of someone who primarily works on like small agile teams, you spend so long like planning out like, okay, and then, you know, you haven't even started making the game yet, right? And you're like, okay, so this is the entire core loop. And then here is the metagame layer that's going to like interface perfectly. You're making a lot of assumptions. You know, you're not really leaving yourself flexibility. So you spend like a month writing this damn document. You're like 2 days into dev and you're like, oh, well, that part isn't fun. So what are you going to do? Like, you're either going to, you could either keep following the document, which is crazy, or you start deviating from it, at which point like large sections of the document become obsolete really quickly.
Yeah.
What I do is like take notes. Absolutely. Like I always have notes. I have a task list. Like I always have like a Trello style kind of like, here is, usually it's like the next 3 days worth of work, because if I come and sit down at my computer to start the work day, it's hard for me to go, like I need to know what I'm launching into right away, or else I stall out when I first sit down at the computer. But realistically, like work that I'm going to do in like 2 weeks time, probably going to change by the time I get there, because as I'm making the game and playing it, like you kind of intuitively starting to feel what works and what doesn't. And the further planned out you are, it's like something comes up and you're like, oh man, you know what would be like really cool to try here? Like, so with the Sir Truck one, it was like, hey, what if we added like a mace, like what if we added melee weapons to this car? Like,
love
none
that.
Of that was ever planned. And then you do one of those and you're like, oh man, that's actually really cool, maybe we can take it further. And if you have all these plans, you kind of immediately have this tension of like, you have the plan that you've spent time thinking about, but then you have what feels like, you know, the the path of least resistance, I guess. And they start to quickly deviate. So,
right.
Yeah, I definitely consider myself a very intuitive designer. I will also say, though, that a game like, I don't know, like a more complicated technical game, like, you know, say a big beefy deck builder or a really life strategy game, I probably would do really poorly at that for exactly, because I don't tend to like wait kind of like pre-planning and foresight in like a really heavy way. I prefer to just do things intuitively. Something else that I would say as well, though, is I'm really big on deadlines. Like, I love having deadlines. When we started Pretty Great, after we did the prototyping for our first game, Landsliders, we flew down to Sydney, met with Apple and said, this is the launch date of our game. And then we hit that date exactly.
What?
Yeah. Because, but the thing is like the way that we do it is the way that that happens is you go, okay, now we're going to hit this date. The game should always be in like a rough, like at least like a playable and fun state. And we will just intuitively keep working on it to make it better and better. And oh, the release date is in 2 weeks. So I guess we're done. Right? Like, versus being, that's like saying the game will be finished on this date is really different to saying the game will be finished on this date and it will have 10 levels and it will have 4 currencies and it will have this metagame layer and it will let people play 35 hours before they get any repeat content. You know, those are two very different statements. So I feel like that kind of like, I really like having deadlines, and I set myself time limits on these prototypes as well, where I'm like, okay, at essentially like 100 hours worth of programming and at the computer time, that's kind of like the cutoff. And I just like feel my way through it up until that point. And then I get to the 100 hours and I'm like, okay, I guess I'm done.
Wow. That, you know, that plays really nicely with some of my favorite game dev advice, which I put in my book. I got to mention it, How to Make a Video Game All by Yourself, out now for $14.99. John Romero, one of my favorite game devs ever, you know, co-creator of Doom and whatnot, said, always maintain constantly shippable code. And this is something I really drill into, because I see indies all the time where they're like, oh, yeah, I had this really cool prototype I put together. And inevitably, I refactored everything and you can't play it right now. I mean, you can't play it right now. And I'm like, I've done that. We've all done that, right? I'm like, no, always keep it playable. But that really puts things into perspective, because that whole calling your shot, you're like Babe Ruth over here. I'm not even a baseball fan and I'm using baseball references, but you're like, that is unheard of. I mean, you know, that is unheard of. Usually game devs are more known for like, you offshoot your date by like 2 or 3x, or like, you know, we got to push it back because we were off by 3 months, or like, very impressive. I love that mentality of always having it playable.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like, it definitely is a different kind of discipline, I suppose. Like, but the other place that, you know, always have something that's ready to ship, the other place that always comes up is in agile software development methodology, right? Like, it's like at the end of every sprint, the game, you know, your product should always be in a shippable state. And that's definitely where I had picked that up from, I guess. Like, to be clear, I haven't always worked this way, right? Like, when we were working in like early license titles, like, we missed deadlines. We, you know, the game would be in pieces and completely non-playable for like months at a time. I certainly don't want anyone to think that like I've got it all figured out and that I've always done things well. Like, oh man, I've been on some absolute shit show projects and like designed some like really crappy games.
Ooh, this is a good opportunity for me to mention one of my favorite videos that you've done, and there are many, but the spooky game dev story.
Oh, the Halloween one.
So fun. Yeah, after I watched, I'm like, what could I do for this Halloween? Because we all have those horrible game dev stories, and you had some really good ones. I'll definitely put a link to that in our show notes.
I think it's helpful to tell those stories as well, right? Because it's so easy to succumb to kind of like survivorship bias, and you know, like you tend to hear from, hear about things that have worked really successfully and all that. And I always really liked it. GDC, they had like the failure workshops for a few years.
Oh, there. Yeah.
Yeah, totally. They were great. Like they were always really good. And there was another really good GDC talk who I can't remember who did it and what the company was, but it was something like, it was like 25 years without a hit, essentially. And that was like a really great talk where it was like, I don't know, it's really good to hear those perspectives because, you know, I think it's healthy and it's unhealthy to hold yourself at like a, you know, you're going to nail everything every single time. And I think especially at the beginning of your career, right? Like, because everyone works differently as well. And, you know, different methodologies work better or worse for different developers. And it's really easy to hear. It would be really easy to hear someone, you know, even like myself say, well, this is how I do it. And then you try it out and it doesn't work for you. And you kind of like, you know, I wouldn't ever want someone to like think about how they're doing things and go like, oh man, I'm really bad at this. I think really it's just about having a lot of introspection and, you know, figuring out what does and doesn't work for you and being honest with yourself too, you know. Like it's also easy, and I've done this especially in my early career, to be like, oh, I blame all of these external factors, and then go, and then, you know, with the benefit of like age and maturity, at least for me, I was like, oh wait, no, I was just probably like a bad manager.
Wow. Well, I think every good manager,
external factors there that were like kind of jerking me around, but I probably didn't, you know, like I should have known that there were those factors and should have planned accordingly. And, you know, there's, I think just being like introspective and like honest, but also kind with yourself and getting like that balance is really important.
Yeah. Yeah, I think every good manager admits at some point that they have been a bad manager. I think that's a sign of a good manager. So
yeah,
good for you. Do you have time for one more interesting question?
Yeah, absolutely.
Great. So you have another video up where you talk about rock climbing, and of course you made a game along with it because that's how you roll. And I think there's some footage of you rock climbing, looking very fit and impressive. And I used to rock climb, and I cannot do what you were doing just in that simple video. I was always like, the highest I could go was like three. I don't know the numbers. Like I was always on the baby rocks when I'd boulder, right? but the question is, where we got here? How do you view work-life balance and getting out into nature? This is a question I want to know a lot about too, because I'm one of these obsessive people who, like, when I'm not working on my game, I shift gears to something else that's sedentary, where I'm just sitting on my butt. I'm drawing pictures now, or I'm doing marketing now, and I'm still just like sitting there. And you seem like you've got a really good, healthy lifestyle with like, or a relationship with life. You go hiking and you go do like physical activities. Is that easy for you, or do you have some system you use to kind of help get you away from the computer and stop obsessing and get out into the world?
That's a really interesting question. It's funny because like I definitely, this is like relatively new for me, like probably over the last 5 years. Certainly, I would characterize most of my career as not having like a healthy work-life balance and not making health and time outside a priority. I've always spent like a bit of time outside. So I grew up like on a farm. I didn't get a computer until I was 16. Like I couldn't really type. I was like very like, you know, like one letter every like 3 seconds kind of thing. Yeah, yeah, like single totally. Finger, like until probably I was like 16 or 17. I wasn't like always at a screen. I always have like a hand-me-down games console though. So I always loved games, but I wasn't like computery, if I was going to make the distinction. When I was at Half Brick, especially at the beginning, I worked a lot. I crunched really hard because like I was really, I really wanted to advance my career. And I absolutely worked my guts out. And then when we started Pretty Great, when I started Pretty Great, like I'd recently come out of like a long-term relationship, and like the way I dealt with that was by essentially like doing nothing but work for years.
Yeah.
Yep. Like literally, if I woke up early, I would go to the office and start working, and then I would work, and then I would go home and, you know, like play Spelunky and then go to bed. Ooh. And do the same.
Speaking my language.
That's it.
My favorite game ever. That's like work as coping mechanism, right?
Yeah. And it was definitely not very healthy. But I did always have like some part of me that was pulling me outside. Cause like I said, grew up on the farm, grew up outside. I did used to surf for quite a while. So I always like enjoyed being outdoors, but I found it really difficult to make it a priority. Mm. I started to do it more and more like towards the end of Pretty Great, when I started to like realize, I was like, what was I at the end of Pretty Great? I guess I was 31, I don't know, early 30s anyway.
Pretty Great age.
And I was like, man, I am not in very good shape, I guess. Like, you know, yeah, like I started to like think about like, I forget what it was, like something happened. I think I might've like gone for like a ride with a friend. I have a friend who like does like a lot of mountain biking. And he just was absolutely burning me off. And it just really made me like feel like that I wasn't like, you know, probably wasn't where I should be given like my age.
Yeah, I hear you.
And so I slowly started to like make it more of a priority. I got into hiking, which was really good. And then I met my current partner who was really into hiking as well. And then that just like really kicked things off. I did used to climb a little bit, and then I started climbing about 3 years ago, and just was like, as someone who's like really, you know, like who's skinny and small, like when I was in high school, there was only really like two sports, and that was rugby league and rugby union. And I am not built for those, you know, like I was a skinny little asthmatic kid who just like played his NES all day. When I started rock climbing, I was like, oh, this is like a sport that kind of like fits me, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. It's like a, you know, like it's something where like my body is kind of like well suited for and can adapt to quite quickly. And then all of that was kind of like coincided with like, I just kind of stopped playing games. Like really, like I barely play games at all anymore. Like I like check things out. But when like a game comes out like Elden Ring, which don't get me wrong, I know is phenomenal and I can appreciate externally, but I can't imagine sitting down to play that. I feel like I sit down at my desk and I do my work and then I get up and I do not want to be near another screen. And I found spending time outside, doing a lot of hiking and climbing, much better for like my mental health. I feel like much more kind of like calm and balanced. And and some of that now is like habit. You know, was it whatever that thing is where it's like it's really hard to get like a habit formed, but once it's there, it's like, you know, so I know that like, Monday, Wednesday, Fridays, I wake up at 5:30 a.m. and then I go climbing for like 2 hours, like every Monday, every Wednesday, every Friday.
No kidding.
It's just like, and now I've been doing it for like a couple of years and it's like, I don't know. It's like, it doesn't feel like anything. I mean, I look forward to it every day. Mm. Where I'm like, heck yeah. Can't wait to get out there and like do some climbing and, you know, like a mix of like indoors and outdoors. But yeah, it's just habit and everything now, and I feel much better in myself, and I think it's a much healthier thing. But doing the solo thing, I do feel like that, like the last couple of weeks, like I will say I've been working a lot of overtime because I'm trying to do a lot of things all at once, and like this Feed the Deep video is done really well, and like a lot of people are responding to the game. But I've also already got something else that I had already started. So I'm trying to finish that. So then I can, I just trying to do like videos, and I'm doing some contract work to keep the lights on. And I'm like, you can feel that draw back towards those days where I'm like, okay, I guess I work 90 hours a week now.
Whoops. Yeah, definitely been there before. Well, you're pulling it off, all of it off really well. And you're looking impressive while you do it. Good job.
Oh, thanks, man. I appreciate that. I hope that like, I guess like I would want to say like I don't want to try and make it look like anything other than it is, you know, like I hope that like through the YouTube videos and everything, I hope I'm giving a mostly like pretty like honest and candid view of things. Cause yeah, the thing that I would definitely want someone to pull me up if it was ever like, that's not actually what's going on.
Yeah.
You know, like I hope it shouldn't ever just be for show. I really just want to show people like what's up kind of thing.
Yeah, I love it. Well, yeah, I can't wait to see your future videos and the future games that come along with it. And thanks a lot for being here today.
Thanks, man. No, thank you for having me. It's a pleasure. That like time literally just flew by for me. So
I'm happy to hear it. Me too. Great. That's it, everybody. Thanks for listening. Be sure to subscribe to Luke's channel on YouTube. Also buy my book, How to Make a Video Game All by Yourself. And lastly, Witchlist, Witchmore on Steam. Hey, while you're at it, tell a friend about this little show, Make the Game, and I'll talk to you next time.